sense tonight begins the feast of Purim in the Jewish calendar, I thought we would spend this morning's lesson talking about the book of Esther. Esther is an interesting book. You always have sort of split or torn feelings in trying to talk about the book of Esther. On one hand, Esther is one of those books that, although Esther is a queen, still it is dealing with the trials and tribulations, in a sense, of everyday people. It's not speaking about prophets. It's not speaking about people who were judges over Israel. But in a sense, although Esther is queen, she is not queen over all of Israel. And in a sense, she has a great many dilemmas before her, which are the same dilemmas that oftentimes beset us in everyday life. The things that, in the book of Esther, though, make it difficult to study, the most obvious thing is that the name of God is not mentioned at all in the book of Esther. That there is no name, God is not mentioned, and prayer is not mentioned. But yet the hand of God is abundantly clear in the circumstances that occur in the life of Esther and in the things that are going on. In another sense, the book of Esther is also sort of a bittersweet book in that, once again, it was speaking about the triumph of the Jewish people over their enemies at this time, whereas there were other times in history, even in recent history, even in the time of the Holocaust in Germany, in the 1930s and the 1940s, when it seemed like God did not react like he did in the time of Esther and did not act to preserve the lives of his people, but instead let his people die to a great extent. Half the Jews in all the world died in the Holocaust in Germany in the 1930s and the 1940s, and that is still something difficult for the Jewish community to deal with. But on the other hand, when we look, turn with me to the book of Esther, let's start actually look at the end of the book of Esther to find out why in the world do we even care. And in Esther chapter 9, down in verse 20, he said, "Then Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to celebrate the 14th day of the month Adar, and the 15th day of the same month annually, because on those days the Jews rid themselves of their enemies, and it was a month which was turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and rejoicing, and sending portions of food to one another, and gifts to the poor." So why do we celebrate it? We celebrate it because it was set forth as a memorial. We saw in 1 Samuel chapter 15, in the Haftorah reading, that Saul set up a monument to himself, but in a sense, Purim and the book of Esther is a monument that Mordecai set up to the testimony of the faithfulness of God in this respect. There are a great many things that occur in the book of Esther that individually are just little tiny small things, but altogether constitute a miracle. It is the very nature of miracles to be rare. If everything were a miracle every day, then we would not live in a logical world. We would live in a world without rules. We would live in a magical world where things just happen without rules and without sense. The very notion of a miracle, what makes it so special is that it breaks the rules. So rather than read through the book of Esther, since it is rather lengthy and to try to get through it would be very difficult, I encourage people to read through the book of Esther, for it is a good read. It is one of the books of the Bible that is also a very easy read. It is not something like the book of Isaiah or the book of Daniel, where there are some very strange and peculiar things going on that take a great deal of effort to figure out. The book of Esther, like I said, reads like something that could have happened in one of our own lives. We ourselves could write down the testimony of how God worked together for something, and it would read very much like the book of Esther. In fact, I would encourage people to do that. If there is something in particular in your life that occurred that was very special, write it down or tell that story or understand what happened when all the things worked together. Because the book of Esther is about a series of things that look like coincidences, but together they work together for God's glory. Another thing about the book of Esther which makes it so difficult to deal with is the fact that before the book of Esther even began, the time of captivity for Israel had ended. The prophesied time of captivity was over. So what in the world were all these Jews still doing in Persia instead of back in Israel? So one thing that makes it a little difficult is the fact that the people that we're talking about here were basically people who began being disobedient to God, being rebellious against God, because the place of blessing was not supposed to be Persia, it was not supposed to be Susa, it was supposed to be Israel. And the fact that all the people were still in the Persian Empire said something about their character, that they did not trust God enough to go back to the land of Israel in that day. The events of the book of Esther, rather than read through it, is the very first thing that happened. The book of Esther begins with a pagan queen being deposed. Vashti, for whatever reason, during a drunken feast that the king was holding, decided not to come at the king's command and stand before the king. We don't know if there was any impropriety there, or it was simply a violation of custom, because in the Middle East, the men and women did not party together. But this was also a great party that was leading up to the Battle of Salamis that the Persians were going to fight against the Greeks. So it was this great pep rally, really, for the upcoming battle. And Vashti did not come when called. Like you'd call a dog, you'd whistle for a dog. She didn't come. So as a result, she lost her office, and historians are not sure whether she lost her life or not. That's still open to debate as to what exactly happened to Vashti. Some people think that she regained her point of prominence later on because some people think that the heir to the throne was actually her son. So as a result, she would have maintained a position of honor as the queen mother when he got back to the throne. So she was deposed. Now you got to remember that this was not a monogamous society and not a monogamous king. He had a harem full of women, and he simply basically appointed one of them as queen, but she only had marginal status above that of the other women in the harem. So when the queen, with her being deposed, it was not like the man was lonely. However, the Battle of Salamis did not go well for the Persians. It did not go well. They were soundly whooped by the Greeks. And so the king came back home, not as a victorious king, but in fact, rather downtrodden after having been really defeated soundly. So where he sought comfort was in his harem, and it was at that point when he longed for the comfort of his queen. Now he couldn't bring Vashti back because that would be even more foolish. So instead, he started this induction of women all over the empire into his harem in order that a new queen might be found. I don't think this was voluntary, by the way. There's some debate about whether Esther went along willingly, and this time of year, congregations have Purim plays and things like that, where it's implied it was a beauty contest kind of thing. I don't think it was a pleasant beauty contest sort of thing. I think the soldiers went through towns, and whenever they found an attractive young lady that they thought would fit well into the harem, they just took her. But she didn't have any say in the matter. Now, her relative Mordecai was a man of high standing. However, for some reason, the relationship between Esther and Mordecai is not well revealed in this. So it's not certain. All the little details how Mordecai and Esther came to the capital independently so that it was not known that they belonged to each other. The account does not give us. But Mordecai overheard people planning a coup against the king. And so rather than just simply laying low and staying silent, he decides to get word to Esther to give to the king. Because after Esther was brought into the harem, she found favor with the king, and she did the things that she was told, and the king found favor in her and elevated her to be queen. Mordecai, however, had this issue with one of the kings of Persia. And that's where this Haftorah reading came in today from 1 Samuel 15. Because the problem that Mordecai has is with this gentleman called Haman. And Haman is called an Agagite. It is very unlikely that he was a descendant of King Agag in the Torah reading. However, some Jewish traditions say that he was. However, there was also a province of Persia known as Agag. So for him to be an Agagite doesn't necessarily mean that he was associated with the Amalekites. So if you hear these wonderful sermons about how God finally getting his vengeance upon the Amalekites, once again, maybe yes, maybe no. Because it is very unlikely. Remember that in the Haftorah reading that Samuel told Agag that his mother would be left without children. And the implication was not that she would just have to enjoy her grandchildren. The implication there was that they had killed everyone but the king himself. And so it was very doubtful that he had descendants. So anyway, Mordecai has a problem with Haman. Now Mordecai won't bow down to Haman. Once again, we don't know why. Like I said, there are difficulties with the book of Esther. We don't know why Mordecai wouldn't bow down to Haman. Because certainly they had no problems bowing down to other princes of Persia. So what the deal was there, we don't understand all the way. But it was something to deal with the fact that he was Jewish. And that, to be fair, does point to something going on. Maybe he was an Amalekite. Who knows? So Haman decides to eliminate not just Mordecai, but all of his people. So he asks the king if he can eliminate a particular group of people, take the money and put it in the treasury. The king stops for a second and says, "Sure, great idea." And so they have a dinner party. They publish a decree saying that at such and such a date, that destruction would be brought upon the Jews and all the property would be seized. First point, well, we'll go back over some of these coincidences later on, but just to summarize the book in case anybody doesn't know all the details of this. So Esther in the harem, Mordecai gets word to Esther and asks her to intercede. She's reluctant because people in general and women in specific were not those who went boldly into the king and demanded things, at least that lived to tell about it. So she very hesitantly agreed to go in and intercede. And we'll look at that section in a little bit as one of the couple of sections we'll look at in the actual book. She intercedes, and rather than asking the king outright to spare her life and that of her people, instead she asks the king to a dinner party. Now remember I said that Mordecai thwarted the plot against the king, and for that the reward he received was exactly nothing. And nothing was done for him. So, and between the time that Esther asked the king to a dinner party, he came to the dinner party and asked for a request. Once again, she didn't ask the real request, but asked him to come back the next day. That night the king couldn't sleep. He read the accounts of his kingdom. If anything would put you to sleep, that would. And so he read that account, and in it was the notation of what Mordecai had done. And he asked his people, "Well, what did we do for this guy? He saved my life." And there was that uncomfortable pause that you get when the boss asks you something, and you know he's not going to like the answer. And eventually, I'm sure somebody in a quiet voice said, "Well, nothing. We didn't do anything." So the king decides he's going to honor Mordecai, and who walks in at that moment but Haman. The king asks, "Well, what do we do to honor someone that the king desires to honor?" Haman, of course, thinking it's himself, because he couldn't conceive of anybody else being in the favor of the king, said that you would march the guy around town dressed in the royal robe and on the royal steed. And that was not just a show, but that increased your reputation and your power and your authority in that culture, in that government. And so the king orders Haman to march Mordecai around town that way. And that's where really the corner turns on this, that now we see the rise of Mordecai and the defeat of Haman. The next day, he comes to the dinner party with the king and Esther, Esther fingers him as the one who's about to kill him and her entire people. And so as a result, they put a bag over his head and they hang him from the gallows upon which he wished desired to hang Mordecai. They've got the problem remaining as to what to do with this decree that said all the Jews are going to be killed, because in Persia you couldn't take back the decree. So instead the king issued a counter decree and said that, okay, fine, this group of people can go ahead and attack the Jews, but now they can fight back. And not only can they fight back, but they can attack anybody they want on that day. They can attack their enemies. That put a whole different slant on things. So as a result of that, on that day, not only weren't the Jews killed, but they also got to eliminate some of their enemies that would have caused hurt further on down the line. So let's go back and look at a couple of details. Chapter 4 of Esther. When Mordecai approaches Esther as to what to do. And so Esther chapter 4, Mordecai hears about this decree and he gets word to Esther. Let's look at chapter 4 is a short one. So let's just look at verse 1 of it. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went out into the midst of the city and wailed loudly and bitterly. I love these people, these ancient people, because you always knew where they stood. It wasn't like he suffered in silence. Too many times in our culture we suffer in silence. These people put on their ashes and wailed. He went as far as the king's gate, for no one was to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. In each and every province where the command and decree of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping, and wailing, and many lay on sackcloth and ashes. Then Esther's maidens and her eunuchs came and told her, and the queen writhed in great anguish. And she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, that he might remove his sackcloth from him, but he did not accept them. Then Esther summoned Hathach from the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what this was and why it was. So Hathach went out to Mordecai to the city square in front of the king's gate. Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact amount of money that Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the text of the edict which had been issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show Esther and inform her, and to order her to go into the king to implore his favor and to plead with him for her people. Hathach came back and related Mordecai's words to Esther. It wasn't like she was back in the palace watching CNN. Right? There is no news there. If you're in the harem, you're pretty much cut off. You only knew what people told you. Right? There is no newspapers. There is no TV. There are no visitors to the king's harem. It was a very protected kind of place. You didn't allow strangers in there. So as a result, she didn't really hear what was going on. Verse 10, then Esther spoke to Hathach and ordered him to reply to Mordecai, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces, know that for any man or woman who comes to the king to the inner court who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And I have not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. So in other words, if you came into the king's presence and he didn't want you there, they hauled you off and they killed you. This was in no way a democracy. This was in no way anything that was of the people, by the people, for the people. This was of the king, by the king, for the king. The king didn't like you. You died. So if you came in, you annoyed him, he hauled you off and you died. So she said, well, not only is this the penalty, but the king hasn't called for me for the last month. Well, if you're in the harem and the king didn't want to see you for a month, maybe he didn't like you. Maybe he didn't like you and he showed up suddenly in his throne room, chances are he wasn't going to welcome you warmly. He was going to tell you to, you know, haul her away. Have off with her head. Verse 12, they related Esther's words to Mordecai. Then Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Oftentimes we get the wrong perspective on things. We look at our lives as if our lives were for our sake. Our lives are for God's sake. You know, we use that as almost a curse, for God's sake. But really, that is, our lives are for God's sake. We live for the glory and the advancement of God's kingdom. So, sometimes when good things happen to us, we're happy and we have no problem thinking this is for the glory of God. When bad things happen to us, we have a hard time thinking of this as being in God's plan and for the glory of God. But either way, it's for the glory of God. But Mordecai is telling Esther, don't think you became queen because of your own sterling qualities. You became queen because of the favor of God. And how do you not know that God put you there just for this moment in time that you have the opportunity to make a difference? Because, I mean, look at the things that happened to bring Esther to this point. Vashti was deposed. She was brought into the haven, the harem. Among all these other women, the king chose her. She's right in the throne room at this time that this threat came forward. God worked all these things together to get her into the right place at the right time. And it would have been easy for her to say, not me, it's too dangerous, find someone else. And oftentimes we do that. Two magic words. I can't. They're magic words, but they're not good magic words, are they? When you plainly see something that God has laid on your doorstep, like a baby in a basket on the steps of a church, the question is, what do you do? It might be a difficult thing. It might be something that looks like an impossible thing. But God, if it is something that God has laid at your doorstep to accomplish, then God will give you the resources to do it. Sometimes it may not look like it. I mean, at that point, Esther is thinking, how in the world am I going to pull this off? And Mordecai's comment to her is basically, well, you don't have to pull this off. God's going to pull this off. You just have to do what you can do. And right now, the only thing you can do is go see the king and make an appeal, and then God will take it from there. God didn't ask her to get a sword and go out and defend the Jewish people. God asked her to do what she could do. I'm sure God's asking you to do some things. Some things maybe that are hard. They're not impossible because nothing is impossible with God. God does not ask you to do things that are impossible. Sometimes we misunderstand what results He expects. That we think God is calling us to do something so we could be rich and happy and this is going to be fun. Whereas God simply wants us to do it because it is going to be effective at advancing the cause of His kingdom. If God calls you to do something, you do it. You do it. So why in the world is God doing this? I mentioned the Holocaust. Move forward with me to Esther chapter 8. Remember what we read about that decree, about what was going out and how the people all were in turmoil. The end of chapter 8, down in chapter 8, verse 8. So this is after all these circumstances came together, so that Mordecai would triumph and Haman would be put to death. Because look at all the little circumstances that occurred between Esther being asked to intercede and the point where deliverance was given. You had the dinner party. First of all, the king agreed to see her, and she didn't die. The king sounds happy to see her. He's so happy to see her that he tells her, anything up to the half of the kingdom, I'll give to you. So he was real happy to see her. And so that was the first thing. Second thing was, at the dinner party, for some reason she put it off to the next day. Some people think she was scared, but I think somehow all those people fasting and praying for her, that God had a plan, and so she put it off for the next day. In the middle of the night, we had that reading of the Chronicles and the discovery of Mordecai and the elevation of Mordecai. So the next day, at the dinner party, then Haman winds up losing his life. And so now, this is that decree that I mentioned, this counter-decree in chapter 8, verse 8. Now you write to the Jews, as you see fit, in the king's name, and seal it with the king's signet ring. For a decree which is written in the name of the king and sealed with this king's signet ring may not be revoked. So the king's scribe recalled at that time in the third month, that is the month Sivan, on the 23rd day, and it was written according to all that Mordecai commanded to the Jews, the satraps, the governors, and the princes of the provinces which extended from India to Ethiopia, 127 provinces, to every province according to its script, to every people according to their language, as well as to the Jews according to their script and their language. He wrote in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed it with the king's signet ring and sent letters by couriers on horses, riding on steeds sired by the royal stud. And then the king granted the Jews who are in each and every city the right to assemble and to defend their lives, to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate the entire army of any people or province which might attack them, including children and women, and to plunder their spoil. On one day in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, the 13th day of the 12th month, that is the month Adar. A copy of the edict to be issued as law in each and every province was published to all the peoples, so that the Jews would be ready for this day to avenge themselves on their enemies. That was the other thing that I failed to mention about this, the other God sighting in the midst of this, was that when Haman cast lots to find out what day to choose, the month that he chose was about as far off as you could get in the calendar, so they had 11 months to prepare. Had he chosen the very next month, it would have been a little bit more difficult. Verse 14, the couriers, hastened and impelled by the king's command, went out riding on the royal steeds, and the decree was given out at the citadel in Susa. Then Mordecai went out from the presence of the king in royal robes of blue and white, with a large crown of gold and a garment of fine linen and purple, and the city of Susa shouted and rejoiced. For the Jews there was light and gladness and joy and honor. In each and every province and in each and every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree arrived, there was gladness and joy for the Jews, a feast and a holiday. And many among the peoples of the land became Jews, for the dread of the Jews had fallen on them. So you're saying, why in the world would God do this? If God turned all this around, in the end, and wound up not only delivering them, but God's kingdom was advanced too. Because it said many of the land became Jews. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means they worshiped the true God. So this was a great evangelistic event, in a sense, because all the people around had seen this great reversal of fortune in which God did this, and they're saying, wow, if God's that powerful, I want to serve Him. So they became Jews. It also says something about how God was working through the character of the land, because the people were sad and upset in the first decree when the Jews were going to be destroyed, and then they're rejoicing when they're being delivered. And they're rejoicing when Mordecai got elevated. That says something about Mordecai's reputation too. And you don't get the impression that people were rejoicing that much at Haman. You almost have the feeling with Haman that they would have thrown fruit at him if they could have gotten away with it. Whereas Mordecai, when he was elevated, that the people were very happy, that it was a very joyous type of occasion. So God worked all this out to His own glory. In the end of it, why do people become Jews? Because they're glorifying God. People wouldn't have become Jews if they hadn't been glorifying God. So God turns all these circumstances around, and it's almost like the physical protection of the people were hitchhiking on the back of this plan to advance God's glory and His reputation among the Persians, among the Persian Empire, which extended, it's like you couldn't pay for advertising like this. This decree went out from Ethiopia to India. And everywhere where it was heard, people rejoiced and understood, and it was an opportunity for the Jewish people to talk about the Jewish God. And as a result, many people came to faith in the God of the Jews. You might be asking, well, how about other times in the history of the Jewish people when God didn't act miraculously to preserve? And why was it so important to preserve the Jewish people? Well, in order for God's plan to go all the way through, there have to be Jews in the world. So that's why when evil rises, one of the first things that it tries to do is wipe out all the Jews. Because you look at God's plan, God required there be a national Israel in order for the Messiah to exist, so that he would be born into national Israel, to walk in a temple, and to give a legitimate offer of physical redemption. There still has to remain Jewish people. Hitler couldn't kill them all, so that Messiah's plans, God's plans for the Messiah to come back, could all be fulfilled, and that all Israel will be saved, as we'll see later on in Romans, in our study of Romans, that might be fulfilled. So this is God's program, that the Jews might be preserved, but it doesn't mean that every single Jew would be preserved. So things like the Holocaust and things like the fall of Jerusalem to the Romans, all these things could still occur in the plan of God and not violate any promises that God had made as viable of the Jewish people. So you got national promises and you got individual promises. God can fulfill his national promises at the same time of protection, while individuals could suffer because of their own unbelief or just because of the sin of other people. So the book of Esther, looking at how these people work, it's very similar to how God works in our lives. It is very rare for an individual to receive the kind of visions that Daniel received. In fact, since Scripture declares itself as having been completed, you wouldn't have those kind of prophetic visions. But those kinds of things that you see and do, that you read about some of the prophets seeing and doing, are outside of our experience. Even some of the things that Paul taught about where he was caught up into the third heaven and saw unspeakable things, that's outside our experience. But the life of Esther and Mordecai, when we're trying to deal with maybe not things on a national scope, but maybe we're trying to deal with an employer who's doing bad things to people, or we're trying to deal with neighborhoods, or we're trying to deal with cities or regions, and we're in the same position as Esther and Mordecai are in, where we have in front of us something to accomplish, and we say, well, I couldn't do that, or that's impossible. Well, look at the ways in which God had worked out the individual little circumstances along the course of time to work out his own plan through flawed people. And God can work out his plan for you and for our area, for our neighborhoods, our workplaces, our families, our nations, through you, by what he's calling you to do, even though it seems right now to be an impossible thing. God can work together all these circumstances in his own time, in his own way, in his own place, in order to bring, in the end, glory to himself and advancement of his kingdom. And he can use you in it, even though right now you're saying, I can't, or it's impossible, or I can't raise my voice, or I'll get fired, or I'll get beaten up. Well, you might, but the consequences for doing nothing are far worse. The consequence of doing the right thing and suffering for it. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, I thank you for the ways in which you have worked in the lives of people throughout the centuries and for the testimony that we have of their lives, of their failings as well as their successes. I ask that in our own lives that you would open up our own eyes, that we might see the opportunities all around us, that we might not dismiss your opportunities out of hand, but that we might go forward and accomplish those great things for your kingdom that you already have set out for us to do, but more importantly, to be the people that you see in your own eyes us as being, that we might glorify you until the return of our Messiah Yeshua. Amen.